This episode of the podcast is sponsored Le'ilah Nishmas, Rabbi Eliezer Skeist, Harav Eliezer Daniel, Ben Harav Eliyahu David Alav HaShalom, whose yard site is the day this episode is airing, Tesfav Sivan, and that is sponsored by his family. If anyone would like to support the podcast or to sponsor an episode, and in general, a listener mentioned to me that I've mentioned recently a number of times about sponsorship opportunities, so he said, well, people don't know how much a sponsorship is. So a sponsorship for an episode is $360. And then you can also support the podcast in a smaller amount. And anyway, is very much appreciated. There's a link in the show's notes through PayPal. And you can email me for nahi@sfarmchatter.com for Zelle or any, again, to sponsor an episode or any other support. Also, if you can, please subscribe. And also on Apple, very much appreciated if you can rate. And also very much appreciated if you can review it as well. Also, stay tuned for the second episode in the Spain series that will be coming this coming Wednesday. Emir Sasham. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Eli Feder, who is the author of the recently published book, Sefer, titled Gematria Refigured, A New Look at How the Torah Conveys Ideas Through Numbers, by Mosaic, published by Mosaic Press. And it's about Gematria, and that's a topic that it's an interesting topic, and listeners will talk to Eli about this. Listeners may have one conception in their mind of what gematria is, and then maybe we'll have another approach here. We'll discuss gematria a little bit. So, thank you for joining me.
Sure, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So let's tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay, so I grew up in Staten Island, and after high school, I went to yeshiva in Farakway, Yeshiva B'nai Torah, and I learned there for many years. I got Yoro and Yodin Yodin from my Rabbi Yisrael Chait. And while I was in yeshiva, I also went to college and to graduate school, and I got a PhD in math from CUNY Graduate Center. And I wrote, my thesis was in something called braid group cryptography. And after that, so I taught 1 year. I was a Rebbe in high school, a local high school, for 1 year. And then I became a Rebbe at the yeshiva I went to. So I've been ever since 2004. I've been a Rebbe and a math professor. So I give a shiur in the mornings, I go to college, and then I give a Gemara shiur in the afternoons during the week. And I give a Chumash shiur. So that's basically what I've been doing. And also I keep myself busy with some math research. I'm in an area called graph theory. So I write, I publish, I give talks. So kind of learn Torah, do some math, combination.
So I'm sure you've been asked this many times, and you actually talk about this in the book, where you're like, okay, gematria, numbers, math, you sound like a number guy, you did a PhD, you said you do research and writing, okay, sure, you must enjoy this, you must be into this. Is that how you became interested in this?
Right, yes, yeah, kind of. So it goes back, the story, my interest in gematria goes way back. So as you know, I'm a math professor and I'm a Rebbe. And back in the day when I was studying, when I was learning in yeshiva and I was studying math, so I would tell people, you know, this is what I do. I'm in yeshiva, I'm in graduate school in math. And they'd always ask me, I'd always get the same question. They'd give me this big smile and say, wow, you must love gematria. And to be honest, at the time, I was not a lover of gematria. It was not something, it didn't talk to me. I didn't really like it even. And, you know, I was polite. I was kind to people. I wasn't mean, but I didn't love gematria. And I'll tell you a little bit about why. So I loved Torah. I loved math, not as much, but I loved math. I loved Torah. Torah was beautiful. The ideas of Torah, every word of the Torah spoke volumes about how to live our lives. Morals and ethics and halacha, the depth of Torah, the beauty of Torah. Every word conveyed meaning and ideas to tell me how all different ideas in my life. And gematria was not, as far as I could tell, wasn't beautiful, didn't convey meaning or depth or insights. It was kind of, in a certain sense, it took the beautiful words of the Torah or of Tanakh, whatever, and it kind of took away their meaning. It took a word and made it into a number, made it into something else. And that's not the way I was used to learning Torah. Learning Torah, you see the words, you see what the word means, you see how it's used in different psukim, you see the mefarshim. Just to have, again, it seemed like to me somewhat superficial. On the other hand, my math side, again, I loved math. I was a math whiz since I was a little kid. It was just my thing. And as I grew in mathematics, I got into more abstract mathematics, the rigors of mathematics, like group theory, graph theory. And I loved math as it got more advanced and more abstract and theoretical. But again, gematria is not advanced mathematics. It's just plus. So it basically, it didn't, even though it sounds like a nice shidduch, you know, rabbi, math professor, that type of thing, it's a good thing, gematria, but it really, it kind of, to me, felt like a little bit not great Torah, not great mathematics. And that was kind of the way I felt for many years.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned gematria is like that. It's like almost like a quippy thing. You say it as like a cute. You always used to someone getting up by the offer for the Shabbos Shabbos Bar Mitzvah. And he's like, oh, the bachur this and the chasen the kala, and they're like, yeah. And then you're allowed to be off by two. You're allowed to be off by one. It becomes like this whole like they're making like a whole like
exactly.
It's like a Purim tirade of something. And so I was like, what's going on over here? Really, this is like
right.
It doesn't feel like that, right? So how did you get more interested in this? Okay, I'm gonna write a book and then get into this. Like, how did you get into the Indian? We'll talk more about it.
Yes. Okay, good question. So the first thing is, look, I was skeptical of gematria. And the question is about how does it's part of Torah. I mean, it's one of those things, it's like you can't just say, oh, I don't like gematria. It's not an option. If you learn Torah, it's part of Torah. You do Marvin Sedra with Rashi. It's like you see gematria all over the place. You go through Gemara, it's all over. It's not one of those things that you could just say, that's not my thing. I don't do gematria. I don't believe in gematria. It's not subject to believing in it. It's part of the Torah. It's part of Chazal. It's all over. So I thought, why don't we see what the source is? What do our Rishonim say about gematria? So there are a few sources that I came across. I'm sure there are many. But a few of them, which I thought are interesting, is, you know, maybe my skepticism of gematria is unfounded. And, you know, so I figure, let's see. So there's I want to cite to you quickly two Ibn Ezra's and the Ramban. Okay. So the first Ibn Ezra, I'll start with Ibn Ezra, which is in Bereishis Yadalad 1414. And he's talking about one of the famous gematrias about the Torah tells us that Avraham went to war with 318 men. And we're all one of the most famous ones, that 318 is the gematria of Eliezer. So it says, Rashi says, it was Eliezer who went, right? So even though the pshat of the pasuk says 318 men, Rashi says it was Eliezer. So the Ibn Ezra on the spot says, Cheshben ha'osios Eliezer derech drash. This count of the numbers, that you take the word 318, take the number 318 and make it Eliezer, is a drash. It's some sort of a exposition of a midrashic exposition. He ain't a custom in davar b'gematria because the pasuk, the Torah doesn't talk in gematria. Ki yachol harotze lahutzi kol shem letov ulara. Because someone who wants could take any name, any word, and make it good or make it bad. Ra kashem kimashmo, a name, a word is what it is. And he's expressing this idea is that you can't look at the pasuk of the Torah and just take them and make them into numbers and change them around to mean different things. But he does say an interesting thing at the beginning. It's a derech drash. He's not dismissing it altogether. He just sounds like he's saying that's not pshat. That's not a way to read the Torah. If you want to read the Torah that way, you could change around Torah to mean lots of different things. So what does he mean? You could take it letova lera. What does he mean by that exactly? So he has another example. Okay, so this is another Ibn Ezra. It's in Shemos, Aleph Zion. He says that there was the Torah. He's talking about this is a gematria which was famous in his time. And I see there's a Rambam in a letter who talks about this also, where it talks about Yishmael. So it says Yishmael Shmaticha Hine Berachti Yosef Veresi Yosef B'Meod Meod. Right? It says Hashem says that I'm going to bless Yishmael B'Meod Meod, a lot, very much so. Right? B'Meod Meod. And he brings down that there were people, Muslims in the time, who said, if you work out the gematria of the Ma'od Ma'od, it's the same as Muhammad. And basically, you see, the Muslims said, the Torah is predicting Muhammad. You see, in Yishmael, Yishmael's descendant is Muhammad. You see that? The Torah predicted this. So that the Ibn Ezra said, he quotes it and he says, what are they going to do when it says the same Ma'od Ma'od by Bnei Yisrael? That's not talking about Yishmael. So Bimod Ma'od has a meaning. It means a lot. It doesn't mean Muhammad. And then he says like this, Ibn Ezra, V'chalila, Chalila, Chaz V'shalom, She'edaber ha'navi v'gematria n'abaramizos. That the Torah, the Navi, will talk in gematrias or in hints and allusions. So again, I think that's what he means when the Ibn Ezra says you could take any name, any word, and make it Latov or Lara. Shabtai Tzvi famously, or has said, the famous Shabtai Tzvi, or infamous Shabtai Tzvi, said, figured out the gematria of Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach HaAmiti, 814. So the point is, and I think there's a Donald Trump gematria floating around, something to do with Mashiach. So everyone hears these. There's tons of them. You could take gematria with gematria. You could, if you're creative enough and you have enough time, you could make a lot of things, support anything you want through gematria. And this is what I see that Ibn Ezra is saying. Now, he's not rejecting it. He's saying it's derech drash. And what does he mean by that? That's a good question. Okay. Now, there's a Ramban also who talks about this. So let me read you a Ramban. And I'm going to read it in English just so it's a little bit longer than Ibn Ezra, but I'll just read it in English just to get the point. So the Ramban is in Sefer HaGeula in Shar Aleph. He writes as follows. He's in the context, he's talking about a gematria. He quotes a gematria in the context which he's discussing. And then he says as follows. Perhaps a person will oppose me for relying upon the calculations of the letters which we refer to as gematria. Such calculations will seem to him to be vanity and emptiness, since a person can derive bad and strange ideas from many verses using this method. Right? That's kind of like Ibn Ezra was. So he says, we will respond, this is the Ramban talking, we respond to the one who asks about this matter in accordance with the truth, namely, that no man is permitted to apply his own gematria calculation and to derive any notion that occurs to his mind. Rather, there's a received tradition which has been passed down by our rabbis, the holy sages of the Talmud, that certain known gematrias were transmitted to Moshe at Sinai in order to serve as a mnemonic device and an illusion for matters which were given orally along with the rest of the Torah. Some in the realm of Agadah and other in the realms of Isser V'Heter. And then he goes on to say he compares gematria to like a Gezer Shava. Gezer Shava, we have a Masorah of Gezer Shavas, but everybody knows you can't just make up your own Gezer Shavas. So Ramban is saying is, look, when I'm talking about gematrias, I understand that people could, now I'm putting in my own words here, that I understand that people could make up their own gematrias and come up with anything, but that's not the idea of gematria. Ramban is saying, when I cite a gematria, I'm referring to gematrias which are part of our Masorah. Ramban is saying, I don't know that everyone agrees with him about this, but he's saying it all goes back to Sinai. And he's saying it's like, in that sense, he's likening it to Gzera Shava. And it's like, it's a way to elude as a Derech Drash or Remez. I think it's Remez is Lashon, as a Smach or Remez to different ideas in the Torah. So that's what I saw is that the Ma'amarcha, the Rishonim, and I think when you have Gematrias all over Rashi, all over the Torah, all over Gemaras, there's Mesorah. There's Gematrias which are part of our Mesorah. And those are great. Those are drash. And that's what my job, I decided, why don't I try to understand those? And then there's gematria, which is just done at every Sheva Brachos, and everyone just makes up their own and comes up with, or Shabtai Tzvi, or Donald Trump, or all those things. And I thought that it's shaykh to draw a line and say, you know what? I think my negative feelings towards gematria, which go back from when I was a kid or whatever, are really towards these homespun gematrias, which kind of people are making up and using in funny types of ways. But what's part of the Torah is the Torah, and there's Chazal, and Gematria is a big part of the Torah. So I kind of thought that was what I decided. I kind of made a split in my mind that says, you know what, I'm going to give Gematria a fair shake, if you will, and I know it's part of the Torah, and let's see if I can understand what the Torah is teaching us about Gematria.
Yeah, and so I think the Ramban, I think you said it's in Sefer Geula, right, the Ramban, and so... However, there are, as you call it, DIY, you know, do-it-yourself gematria. There are those, obviously, they do with countless svarim on Chumash and other, you know, Rabbanim and Gedolim throughout the centuries that do such a thing. I think you mentioned in your book, the Balaturim, of course. Everyone knows the Balaturim. Balaturim has many that are not found anywhere that he's seemingly made up and invented. But you're trying to show, and as you're saying, is that there are the Shittur Rishayim, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, and others that says, no, there is a Messiah on this. So, okay, I think now we can go into, once you lay that out, exploring a little bit more. So you got back into Gematria.
Yes.
So why did you decide to get back into it, or get into it for the first time, really? And from there, I mean, how do you understand Gematria then?
Right. Okay, good. Great question. So I don't remember. It must have been a long, long time, 25 years ago. I don't know, 20 years ago. I decided at one point, I just had this, I guess, epiphany that let me try to, I'm a math guy. People are always asking me if I like it. Let me just try to analyze, take a chazal, take a gematria, which like according to Ramban's thing, is part of a Masorah. And let's see if I could. Again, I learn Rashi's. I know how to learn Rashi. I know how to learn the Rishonim. Let's see if I can learn it and gain some insight. Maybe actually gematria is not just a word game, or not just. Maybe it's actually teaching us something. Let's try to analyze it. And let me. That's what I said. Let me take one Rashi, one gematria, and see if I can learn from it. And when I decided there was a Rashi, it was like I think it was the Parsha of the week or whatever was is in Parsha Chayesara. And again, this is another famous gematria. It says Avram Zakin Baba Yamim. Hashem berachas Avraham ba'kol. Avraham was old in age, and Hashem blessed Avraham ba'kol with everything. So ba'kol, what does ba'kol mean? So if you look at the Ibn Ezra, the Ramban, they say it means everything. Length of days, honor, wealth, children, everything a person desires. Hashem's bracha, we know Avraham was the pinnacle of success. He had everything. Hashem gave him to absolute success. And that's what the plain pshat of the pasuk, again, according to Ibn Ezra, the Ramban, means. It means Hashem blessed Avraham with everything. Everything means a lot of things. But Rashi on the pasuk says, Bakol Ola Bigamatria Bain. Okay, so Bakol is 52. That's 2 and 20 and 30 is 52. And Bain is also 52. And right now that he has a son, it's time to go get him a wife. And sure enough, this is the beginning of Chayesara. When Avram's sending Eliezer to find the wife for Yitzchak, right? So Hashem is on Bakal, Rashi's saying, doesn't mean everything, but it means a son. And I ask the following question, is why is Rashi doing this? That's not what the pshat of the pasuk means. The Torah is telling us that Hashem gave Avram everything. We know Bakal means everything. Why take Bakal, which means everything, and chop it up into numbers, and then find another word which means the same thing, and take it out of the push-up shot. What's the point of such a thing? What's it teaching us? What do we learn from this Rashi? Okay. So I decided, you know what? Let's think about the pasuk itself. The pasuk is telling us Hashem bless Avram with everything. Okay, how does a person truly have everything? Okay, if I were to ask you, what would you want? Such that you would say, I have everything. What does that mean, everything? Imagine a genie would come to you and he says, you know what? I'm going to give you everything. Make a list. Okay, start writing. So you imagine you take out a paper and pen and you start writing a house, the cars, this, many cars, many houses, and you keep writing and you're writing and you're writing and you have a few pages and pages and pages and you keep writing. And you make this long list of things, which is everything. And maybe it takes you 10 minutes. I don't know how long it takes. And then at the end of the time, the genie says, okay, is that your list? You got everything? And I don't know about you, but I'd probably say, oh, hold on a second. No, not so fast. I got a few more things to add on. And the idea is that it's very hard, almost impossible, for ordinary people to ever say, I have everything. As the pasuk in Kohelet says, Oev kasef, lo yispa kasef. Person who loves money will never be satisfied with money. We always seem to want more. As a Chazal says, a person say, Ein adam yotzim in olam v'chatzi taivaso biyado. Person doesn't go out of this world with even half of his desires in his hand. You have 100, you end up wanting 200. You have 200, you end up wanting 400, and so on. So bakal, the term bakal, is an elusive term. How in the world could a person ever have bakal? But yet, the Torah tells us, Hashem berachas Avraham bakal. He had everything. How does a human being ever have everything? And I think the secret to it is really there's another pasuk and a Ramban on the pasuk which gives us an insight. The pasuk says, "Vayigva vayamas Avram b'seva tova zaken v'saveya." So Avram died zaken v'saveya, old and satisfied. He said, "What does this mean? Satisfied? It's another one of those words. How does a person gain be satisfied? Right?" So he says He explains this is a midah which exists by tzaddikim. It also says it when David died. And so he says, what does it mean? He says, it tells us, Ramban, I'm citing what the Ramban says. It's the Ramban, it's in Chathei Ches. He says, it tells us the chesed Hashem to tzaddikim and their midah tova and their good character traits. Shelo yus'avu b'mos saros. They don't desire extravagances, luxuries. And I think what he's teaching us is that a normal person has a desire for luxuries. See, we often don't differentiate between our needs and our wants. Our needs are finite. We could assess what's important to us in our lives. What do we really need? What's going to make us happy? And that's one thing. But then we have our wants. Our wants are infinite. Whatever our wants keep growing and growing and growing. Whenever we get something, we look around at our neighbors. Our wants go on and on and on. And that's the idea of mosros. They're extras. They're extravagances. They're luxuries. A person who's looking for to satisfy these wants, the mosros, they'll never ever be able to say they have bakal. The secret to being able to die satisfied, like Avram did, is he acknowledged what does he truly need, what's important to him in his life. And what was important to Avram in his life? Avram discovered HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he saw it as his life's mission to teach the world about HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to create a nation which is going to be able to pass down the ideas which he discovered to generation after generation after generation. And that was his whole life's mission. And he assessed, what does he need to make that happen? It wasn't going to happen with Eliezer. Ben Meshach Beis Yehuda Meshach Eliezer. It wasn't going to happen. Rashi says he's Aror, and it's not going to work. And Eved's not going to be able to be the father of a nation. He needed to have a son. So what did Avraham need? Avraham had a lot of things, and Hashem gave him a lot of things. But what was on Avraham's list? There was only one thing that was on his list, which was a ban. Without a ban, he assessed that he was not going to be able to do it. He wasn't going to be able to teach the world about it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. With a ban, no matter whatever else he has or doesn't have, he'll be able to do it. So when it's saying is bakal, Rashi is teaching us that the only reason it was even possible for Avraham Avinu to have bakal is because he had this proper assessment, this outlook in life. So did Hashem give him everything? Yes, of course, the pshat and the pasuk is Hashem gave him many things. But what enabled him to be satisfied, to be able to say, I have bakal, was because Hashem, because he had that midah. For example, you see Yaakov Avinu also. There's a difference between Yaakov Avinu and Esav. Yaakov Avinu said, Yesh li kol, and Esav said, Yesh li rav, I have a lot. So you see, a person like Yaakov, a person like Avram could have everything. A person like Esav could have a lot, but he can't have everything. So the question, though, is, fine, so Rashi is teaching us an idea like this, that bakal for Avram is a bane, but what's the point still? That's a point that's almost, there's a point we've heard before. This is a familiar idea, it resonates. It rings true to us. It's something which we'd love to try to incorporate into our lives. But why do you need to use a gematria to teach this? What's the point of, it's an idea, but what's the sense of specifically using gematria to teach this? Why do Chazal use gematria? Why do they take beautiful words and convert them into numbers? So here's the insight. Okay, and this was the insight I had many years ago, and I've kind of gone with it. You take the word bakal. And bakal is a word, according to the pshat of bakal, is really an infinite pshat. Bakal is everything. For a plain person, bakal is keeps going and going and going and going. It's infinite. It can't be quantified. When do you have bakal? It keeps going. For Avram Avinu, bakal was finite, was quantifiable, was 52. And the idea of using a gematria, by taking a word which has an infinite implication, and making it finite, making it quantifiable, using gematria, which is a method which takes a word and makes it a quantity, it conveys the nature of the idea which this Rashi is trying to teach us. It's showing us the secret to bakal. The secret to bakal is to having a finite, quantitative assessment of what's really important to you, what are your needs. And that's why specifically the tool of gematria is exactly the tool which is targeting the type of idea which it's trying to teach. It's using a quantitative method to teach an idea about this word, which is not infinite, but it's finite, it's quantifiable.
So that kind of example, though, is that kind of specific to bakal? How did you take that, and then you said that you came upon this as like your about gematria. How do you go with this and run with this into other ones? Like you said, anyone who learns Rashi is familiar with gematria, Balaturim, other Mefarshim, Chazal. You see gematrias all over. How do you explain other gematrias now?
Yeah. Okay, good. Excellent. So this little Dvar Torah, which I just told you, when I discovered this idea, I was very excited about this. And I used to when you're a Rav or when you're, you have to always have, or your student, you always have to have a Dvar Torah handy. And this was my handy pocket Dvar Torah. Whenever anyone would call on me to say Dvar Torah, I'd pull this one out, especially if it was near Chayzara. So this was I often would tell people this Dvar Torah. when people would hear it, they'd really like it, but they'd always ask me the same question which you just asked me, Achi, which is, how do you explain this? A million gematrias. Is this just one gematria, or is this somehow generalizable to others? And they always said the same exact answer. I don't know. That's what I said. I don't know. That's a great question. I knew that this was a start, but you're right. It seemed to me exactly as you're suggesting. It seems too specific, too tailor-made to this idea. Bakol is a word which means infinite, and they're taking it and making it finite and quantified. It just seemed too specific. And that was it. This was, you know, I'd always give the same answer. Everyone always chuckle and say, oh, that's interesting. And that was the state of my relationship to Gematria for many years. About 5 years ago, I don't even know how it happened, but I don't know, maybe I told my daughter this Dvar Torah, and she said it over in her class, and then her teacher asked, could you do this for other Gematrias? I said, you know what? I'm going to try to see if I could apply this to other areas, other Gematrias, and see what happens. I don't know. We'll see what happens. So sure enough, Baruch Hashem, I was successful, as I think. You know, you could read the book and see if you agree or you don't agree. But I kind of was able to, I realized that two things. First of all, I was trying to copy. Sometimes I thought about the Gematrias and I was trying to copy the exact same thing. And it never worked. It was too specific. And also I decided, I don't know, I just figured out how to take a step back, if you will, and try to analyze the different given areas of Chumash or Rashi and see what I could learn from them and see, maybe Gematria will, maybe the same thing will work, maybe it won't. But let's just try to analyze the given areas. Okay, so why don't I tell you, I think it will be best off if I tell you what I've discovered, I guess what you could call a theory or an approach to why Chazal use Gematria. Okay, and I'll express you what I mean, and I think it will only become clear, you know, what I'll express the main idea, but I think it will only become clear through examples. Okay, but here's the, I'll tell you the basic idea. Sounds good? Yeah. Okay, so here's the Chazal use Gematria when they want to direct your attention to a specific kind of idea. They don't just use Gematria all the time. They use Gematria for a very specific reason, in order to direct your attention to an idea involving quantity. Okay? I'll explain a little bit. Again, Gematria is a quantitative method. It's a method which takes a word and makes it into numbers. And Chazal use Gematria as like a hint, if you will, to direct your attention. There's some insight here involving quantity which you wouldn't have otherwise noticed. There's an unsuspected role of quantity in this area of analysis. And they're trying to highlight the significance of quantity in this area in a way that you might not have otherwise realized. Okay, now that's, again, you may not know what I'm talking about, as many listeners, but that's the theory for now. And then I'm going to, I'll start with one example, and maybe through some examples, I'll try to explain what I mean by that. But that's the basic idea. Quantitative method is directing our attention to quantity. Okay, so let me give you a plain example. I think the easiest, just quick example that I could get. Okay, and then we'll go into the ones that are a little bit longer, but this is, I think, the plainest, simplest example. So if you think about the laning on Tisha B'Av, okay, the laning on Tisha B'Av tells us, Kisolis, this is in Dvarim Dalet Chafei, 425. He says, Kisol ibanim of nevanim, when you have children and grandchildren, v'noshantem ba'aretz, and you become old in the land, v'shchatem asisem pesel t'munas kol, and you're going to go corrupt, and you're going to have a dezara, and you have asisem harab b'neshem l'kecha, right, and so on and so forth. And Hashem testifies, ki ovo toveidun, maher, you're going to quickly perish from the land. Okay, so it's a dire prophecy, which is very sad, and this is what I read about on Tisha B'Av. What does it mean when you get, you have children of no shantem ba'aretz, you're going to get old in the land. So Rashi tells us that this word v'no shantem is a hint that they're going to go to galus, they're going to exile at the end of v'no shantem. The gematria of v'no shantem is 852. That they're going to go into galus at 852 years after they come into Eretz Yisrael. And he says, but if you check it out, it wasn't actually 852 years, it was 850. And it says that, Rashi says that, that Hashem, in a certain sense, was had rachmim on us. And he preceded our exile 2 years early. Why? Because if the first half of the pasuk would have come true, that we were in the land for 852 years, then the second half of the pasuk would have come true, or the next pasuk, which is ki avod tov yudun maher, that you're going to perish, you're going to totally get destroyed. And it's saying is by HaKadosh Baruch Hu being merachem on us and not allowing us to have our full 852 years, he ended up also not fulfilling the end part, which is that we'd utterly perish and be totally destroyed. It was a chesed Hashem. Okay. So the question is, what's the idea? What's the point? And again, why use gematria to teach us this point? Okay. So I think the idea perhaps is that, see, when we think about evil, we think about rishos, and we think about Hashem punishing rishaim, rewarding tzaddikim. We often think about the world as like good guys and bad guys, tzaddikim or rishaim, black or white. We don't recognize the gray. And we think that either the Jews are bad or they're not bad. But the answer is no, that's not true. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's a measure. Like Chazal say, Hashem's measure of, he treats the good 500 times as much as for evil, right? He rewards the good for 2,000 generations and evildoers for 4 generations. The measure of the Midah Tova is 500 times that of Midah Ra. So you see that there's a measure, there's quantity in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's din. And a person could be evil, and he could be more evil, and he could be even more evil than that, and he could be even more evil than that. And there's many, many degrees of evil. And the same thing in the Garden Sidkus. And it's saying is that the Jews had a descent. When it was time for the Chorban and the Galus, they were getting worse and worse and worse. And because he's telling us, the Rashi is saying is that Hashem's prediction is that they're going to descend to the depths of evil. 852 years, the quantity of evil is going to get so bad that there's not going to be any turning back. And ki ovei tovei don maher, that's, you're going to be totally destroyed. And the chesed Hashem was that he stopped the bleeding early. He stopped the after 852 years, we were less evil. The quantity of our evil was less, but that little bit made the difference that we were possible to do to return in tshuva. So that was the rachum of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is that he measured the quantity of how far our descent to evil was. And ultimately, it's a matter of quantity. The key to our survival was the quantity of how bad we got. And the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's din takes into account quantity, and it matters. It makes a difference exactly how much. You have the same thing by Shechem, the five cities by Shechem. There's another gematria there that says the one city that was saved was Tsoar. And Lot asked, Imalta na shama, please let me run there. Please let me run there. It's a small city. And Rashi says, no, gematria is 51. Because Tsoar was settled 51 years. And the other cities were settled in 52 years earlier. So Tsoar had 1 year less of their descent to evil. And that 1 year made all the difference. The quantity, the difference between the cities, the reason why Tsoar was able to be saved and the other cities had to be turned over was because it was 1 year less. And again, Rashi is the gematria that they share the same message. What saved Tsoar and what saved Kal Yisrael is the less time, the less descent to evil, the quantity. And Chazal specifically using gematria to direct our attention to the role of quantity in the Midas Kadosh Baruch Hu of his din. So that's the general idea. The general idea is that specifically Chazal are using gematria to direct our attention in a way that we may not have otherwise noticed to the role of quantity. That's why they're using a quantitative method to highlight that point.
Interesting. If you have other examples, did you want to mention another example before we go on to talk about some maybe funny gematrias?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, what do you mean by funny? Why don't we start with that?
So I mentioned one of them earlier in the beginning of, you know, of the podcast, which was, you're allowed to be off by a few. It's okay to be off by a few. So then, you know, it's not exactly, that's just something, it's not adding up. It's not adding up. The word doesn't add up to this, but no, if you include this, the number of the words, and all sorts of other cheshbainas come in. Actually, those are almost two different things. We can get into that. But
yeah.
So you're allowed to be off by a few, and we can really lump them together. You're off by a few, and then you can add in different stuff. You have like Rashi and Tzitzis. You have like, well, the Tzitzis and the Tzitzis drinks. I think like everything comes in by Taryag. I think you mentioned this, I think you have it in the book, right? Because the Chatzim is called Mitzvot. Rashi says the Gematria of Tzitzis is 600, And then you have the aged drinks, and you have Shmoy Nechutin, Chamisha Ksharin, and the nuts, and you get to Taryag. I mean, suddenly it's like, it doesn't add up. The numbers are not bad. Or then you have the other ones where, like, you're off by two, but it's okay. Right.
Okay,
people
good.
Always probably bothered by that. So what's the story with those?
Yeah, okay. So I'll take up one of those. I mean, it's funny. Those are both about Taryag Mitzvah. So again, there's two. What I do in my book is I have different chapters. So one of them I call almost the same gematrias, which is the point you're mentioning, gematrias which are off by two or whatever. And another one is called patchwork gematrias. And that's the idea of the tzitzis is like a patchwork, you know? So let me talk about the almost the same gematrias. So the idea that gematrias could be off by a few, so I didn't really see that explicitly in Chazal. I know that that's used in later works, but I didn't see that. But I did see one example, which is almost like that, or on the surface is like that, but I don't think it's quite like that. But I'll talk about that. Okay, so that's the famous, again, where I'm sure we're familiar with this, is the Gemara in Makos on Chav Gimel and Beis. It says, Rasim Lo is Dore, she says, the Torah Hashem gave 365 mitzvahs aseita. Shesh Mil Shal Shesh. So 613 mitzvahs were given to Moshe, 365 lavim, negative commandments corresponding to the days of the year, and 248 corresponding positive commandments corresponding to the limbs of the body. Okay, and he says, what's the pasuk? What's the source of the pasuk? So it says, Torah Tzivalanu, Moroh Shakil Yaakov. So Torah Tzivalanu, what's the gematria of Torah? 611, right? So that's what Mar says, it's 611. It's not 613. So it says, it says, Anochi and Loiya, the first two of the Sefer Dibros, this week's parsha, were from HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, right? So we have so Torah Tzivalanu Moshe. Moshe commanded us Torah 611, and the final two are from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, so this is one of those that's like off by two, right? But it works. It's like it's clever by the Chazal because it ends up working. It's true. It's not saying that there are 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. It says Torah Tzivalanu Moshe. Moshe gave us 611. And then the final two, which is as I'll say, is the final two in Pirkei Gevurah. Right? But it's still one of these things. I think these are the types of things that make people like kind of, you know, it's not quite a great fit, or right? Those are the types of things which bother people, right? Okay, So here's the way I was thinking about this. So again, this is one thing I learned in my approach of gematrias is that, again, see, I got excited when I hear this quantity theory, and I try to always just stuff in quantity, but it never works. Okay, that's learning in general. As you know, you can't force answers. You have to kind of learn the area on its own, see where it goes, and see if it ends up fitting, it ends up fitting. If it doesn't end up fitting, it doesn't fit. So I decided, you know what, forget gematria, forget quantity, forget anything. Let's just think about the area itself. So what's it telling us? It's telling us when you hear the Chazal, in the very Gemara, there's a differentiation between, first of all, between mitzvah sasei and mitzvah lo sasei, right? And it's telling us there's 613 mitzvahs, there's a differentiation between the positive commandments and the negative commandments, right? 365 lo sasei, 248 positive mitzvah sasei. Okay, is it okay with the Hebrew? And I'm okay?
Do I have to translate? I think it's good, yes.
Okay, fine. So I'm kind of mixing or whatever, but I don't know exactly the crowd. Yeah, okay, fine. So there's one differentiation we see in the mitzvahs, positive and negative, but there's another differentiation, which is that of the mitzvahs that were Hashem that's directly told us, namely the first two, and then the 611 mitzvahs, which we had from Moshe Rabbeinu, which were commanded via Moshe Rabbeinu. We heard through Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Okay. So let's try to think into these different classes, different classifications of mitzvahs, if you will, between the Aseis and the Los Aseis, between the Moshe Rabbeinu and, you know, given Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And before I do that, let's just think about mitzvahs as a class. Well, what is the, I guess you could say, the idea, say, a purpose of mitzvahs? So there's one of my favorite Rambans on the Torah. I'm not sure how many people have this also, but the Ramban al Torah on Kan Sipor, on Shiloh HaKan. So he says the purpose, you could say, of mitzvahs. And I'm just going to read you like a snippet. I have it here in Hebrew, but I'm going to translate it in English. So, you know, I feel like if I read in English, it's going to sound like I'm just reading a text. So I'm going to kind of read it to myself and say what he's saying. He says like this. So the Ramban says like this, that every mitzvah has a reason and a benefit and a tikkun, like a fix to a person, besides the schar that he gets from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, every mitzvah has a benefit to a person. And he continues, he says, that the benefit of the mitzvahs is not to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, he doesn't need our mitzvahs. But it's always the benefit is to man himself, either to prevent him from a nezek, from a harm, or a corrupt emunah, or a bad belief, or a bad midah, or it's to help us remember the miracles of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Creator, to know about Hashem. And then he comes skipping a little bit, and he says, the mitzvahs are also to remove from our hearts corrupt ideas, and to teach us the truth, and to teach us, help us remember HaKadosh Baruch Hu all the time. And he says, therefore, he says, all the mitzvahs are for our benefit. And he quotes a pasuk in Iyov, which says that if you sin, what could you do to him? All the averos that you do, don't do anything to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and so on. And he says, and he ends, he says, this is something which is muskam, which is accepted according to all of the Rabbeinu. And his idea is that the mitzvos are not, Hashem made the whole world, he doesn't need us to do mitzvos, but the mitzvos are there to benefit us. And every mitzvah, he's saying, even chukim are not mitzvos that don't have a benefit, we just don't necessarily know the benefit. But everyone knew them, Shlomo HaMelech knew all of them, except for Paraduma, and so on. So he says, mitzvos are there to benefit us. And when he's talking about the benefit, though, I think if you want to think about the benefit which mitzvos give us, we could classify, and I think it seems there's a clear classification between asays and los asays. And that's, I think, what this Gemara is teaching us, that if you have a study of the mitzvos, of Tayag mitzvos, the most basic distinction of Tayag mitzvos breaks down into two classes, the positive mitzvos and the negative mitzvos. And within that, that's one distinction. And the other distinction in this is the mitzvos that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us directly, which are two mitzvos. There's one mitzvah is Anochi, Anochi Hashem Alakacha, and so on. And the other is Avodah Zarah, Lo Yihyeh Lecha, don't have other gods. And what I'd like to suggest is that in a certain sense, what this Gemara is doing is it's classifying the mitzvos. It's saying that there's two classes of mitzvos, Aseis and Los Aseis. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us two mitzvos. He gave us Anochi, you should know about Hashem, and Lo Yihyeh Lecha, you can't have any Avodah Zarah. And those two mitzvos are paradigms for the 611 mitzvos that were given through Moshe Rabbeinu. So Hashem gave us two mitzvos directly, one positive, one negative. The one positive which Hashem gave is elaborated on, in a certain sense, the other positive mitzvos are like a pirush, and expanding upon the one mitzvah Hashem gave us. And then the 364 negative commandments are like an expansion upon the one negative commandment that Hashem gave us. Okay, and let me explain what I mean. So on that pasuk, what is the idea of this mitzvah of Anochi, right? What is the mitzvah of Anochi? It's a funny mitzvah. Again, it's this week's parasha, these mitzvahs, right? So what is Anochi? So the Ramban on this, on Anochi, he says as follows. He says, what is the mitzvah? He says, it's a mitzvah, and it's commanding us that we should know and we should believe that there is Hashem, that he's a God, that he exists, that he is first, that everything is from him by his will, and he has all the yecholas, he's able to do anything, and he judges people, and we're obligated to serve him, and so on. And he's basically, and he elaborates on it, but basically he's saying is that the idea of the mitzvah of Anochi is that we should know, Anochi Hashem Alkecha, we should know that God exists, we should know all the fundamental ideas, and that's what he elaborates, Anochi Hashem Alkecha, Hashem Tzizichem Yeretz Mitzrayim, that you took us out of Mitzrayim, and he shows how Yetzias Mitzrayim showed Klal Yisrael and the world, all the ideas about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's the mitzvah, is to pursue the knowledge, to learn the fundamental ideas about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in a certain sense, that mitzvah of Anochi, that we should acknowledge and know about HaKadosh Baruch Hu and appreciate all the ideas about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is in a certain sense a paradigm of all mitzvah saseis. Every mitzvah saseis in some way or another is to teach us about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to teach us ideas, how to relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we take a lulav and an esrog, we think that Hashem is the source of our monetary, of our agricultural success. When we give tzedakah, we're remembering that Hashem is the source of our financial success. When we daven, we think that Hashem is the one who supplies all our needs. When we wear tefillin and tzitzis and mezuzah, we remember Hashem, that our bodies, our clothing, our homes are ultimately dependent upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Anochi is one mitzvah to know about Hashem. But in a certain sense, all the mitzvahs asay, that was one mitzvah Hashem gave to Moshe Rabbeinu, that gave us directly. And then the other mitzvahs asays are reminding us in every single aspect, like every limb of our body, we have to recognize the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And that's like I'm saying, I said, Anochi is a paradigm of all the other mitzvahs that were elaborated upon by Moshe Rabbeinu through Moshe Rabbeinu. And I want to say the same thing is the case when it comes to Lo Yiyah. Okay? Lo Yiyah says don't have any other gods, right? Don't have any other gods. So there's a famous, as I guess as you say, it's a Rambam, it's in Avodah Zarah, but it's a Gemara in Kiddushin, it's a Gemara in Nedarim. It says that the mitzvah of Avodah Zarah is equal to all the other mitzvahs of the Torah. And Chazal derived that from a pasuk. And it says, it teaches us if a person accepts, admits about Avodah Zarah is true, he's denying the entire Torah. And if a person denies Avodah Zarah, then he's accepting the entire Torah. Okay? So there's like, he's saying this one mitzvah, lo sase, lo yielecha, is equated to all the mitzvahs of the Torah. And on the surface, it's difficult to understand. There's so many mitzvahs in the Torah. Avodah Zarah is one thing. It almost seems like an ancient thing. Who does Avodah Zarah anyways? And it's like all the mitzvahs of the Torah are corresponding to Avodah Zarah. So what does that even mean? So I think in a certain sense, we could think about it. See, what is Avodah Zarah and what is so bad about Avodah Zarah is that in a certain sense, the Avodah Zarah is like the antithesis of the Torah. In Torah, we serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the nations serve their other gods. And we say Aleinu, that Shehem Ishtachim, Hevel Varuk, they serve emptiness and nothing which cannot save them. But what do? We don't turn, it's interesting, it says they serve emptiness and nothingness which can't save them. It doesn't say we serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu who could save us. We say we bow to the Melech Malchayim, Melech Malchayim, Kadosh Baruch Hu, who created the heavens and spread forth the heavens and all that. Ultimately, the nations of the world, they serve, the idea of Avodah Zarah is serving a God. It's like a self-serving idea. You make up a God because you're looking for salvation. You're looking to be able to, you have fears, you have wishes, and you make up a God in order to serve those, to help you. But we serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu first and foremost because he's true. And yes, it's true, he does save us and he does take care of our needs, but ultimately, it's the Torah is about MS, Hashem Elokim MS, and Avodah Zarah is Sheker. And the idea is that, and in that sense, I think it means, we could, the life of Torah is the pursuit of truth. And all the lo sases are keeping us away from false values. In that sense, Avodah Zarah is like a worldview which is informed by a person's wishes, by his fears, by his desires. So a person, like people say, you know, they say this in school when you're a kid or whatever, like, you know, like the TV is Avodah Zarah and money is Avodah Zarah and test server, whatever else, you know. So anything's about Avodah Zarah. But the point is that we could have different Avodah Zarahs. But I think the idea is that we could have false values. Like our world values pleasure above all else, values fame above all else, values money above all else. And these, in a certain sense, the Torah is trying to, the ultimate good in Torah is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is truth, is our worship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And all of the Torah's lo sases could be viewed as keeping us away from false values, which at the head of them is Avodah Zarah. And the idea is like, again, all the mitzvot like Machalas Asuros and Nisur Bia are trying to, a person has a natural tendency to saying like a pleasure is the good. And the Torah, the lo sases are where we're getting us away from that. And all the monetary, you know, restrictions, all the laws involving the way we make our loans and we do business and all that teach us how to not relate to money as the ultimate objective. But we have to recognize that money is only a means towards being able to serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu. All the interpersonal mitzvahs, like Lashon Hara and Rechilas and Kena, all those are so that we don't get caught in other false values of our pettiness and our competitiveness. And that's what I'm saying. In some sense, Lo Yiyah is saying, besides Anochli is all the positive mitzvahs remind us of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we have many 247 mitzvahs that are elaborated on that remind us of HaKadosh Baruch Hu all the time. But we need Sur Meira V'Asei Tov. It's two parts of the picture. And Lo Yiyah Lecha is the heading. Hashem told us Lo Yiyah, and then gave Moshe Rabbeinu, who says, throughout every day of the year, every single facet of your life, you have to recognize there's so many things that pull us away. And all these lo-sases are elaborations on this on Avodah Zarah, on teaching us other negative things, things which are harming us. Okay, so that's what I'm suggesting, is that this Gemara in Makos is classifying all the mitzvos under these two headings, the two mitzvos that Hashem gave to us, and then the 611 are the elaboration on those mitzvos. Now, at this point, what does it have anything to do with gematria? Nothing really, right? Okay. So say a thing like this, is that there are these two classes of mitzvos. There's the ases and there's los ases. There's anochi and there's lo yeh. So under each class, there's a quantity. How many mitzvos? Again, we have one idea of anochi. You have to recognize the Kadosh Baruch Hu. But how many mitzvos do you need to recognize the Kadosh Baruch Hu? How many? There are 248 ases, or 247 plus this one. How many do you need? You could argue you should have a million mitzvos to remind you of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You could argue you should have three or four. And I think the answer is there's a balance. It's like, in a certain sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu carefully measures the quantity. There's a fine tuning, if you will, in the right balance. If there's too many mitzvos, then we'd always be busy. We never have time to sit and learn and think and to live our lives. We had a million mitzvos every single second. We had to do a different mitzvah. We'd never be able to stop and live. On the other hand, if we had too few mitzvos, if we only had three mitzvos or five mitzvos, it wouldn't be enough. Part of our life, the religious life of the Jews, we're very frequently reminded of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And there's a balance. There's the right quantity. Hashem, we don't know exactly why that's the number. We don't know why Hashem, any of the numbers Hashem built into our universe, we can't figure out exactly. But there is a balance. It's about right. The number of mitzvos, the 248, is about the right balance. It's not too much that we can't live our lives. It's not too little that we forget about a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And the same thing with the los ases. The Torah, there are many, many draws of our energies. And the Torah gives us many los ases to avoid all different types of negative harms. But if there could be millions of Isurim, or there could be only two or three. But there's a balance. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm suggesting here, is the Gematria is directing us to that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu fine-tuned the quantities of mitzvos. There's the perfection of the Torah. There's the ultimate Chachmas Hashem in the Torah, not just of giving us a beautiful Torah with beautiful mitzvos and different classes of mitzvos, but the quantity of the mitzvos. 613 isn't just an accident. The number of mitzvos is part of the design of the Torah, of the Chachmas Hashem, is to fine-tune the right quantities. And science has discovered nowadays there's fine-tuning of quantities in our universe. The laws of physics are fine-tuned, and they're an illustration of the great Chachmas Hashem, how the numbers are just right. And if the numbers were not just right, then the whole universe would be chaotic and we wouldn't have anything. So too in the Torah and the mitzvos, there's a fine-tuning, there's a Chachmas Hashem in the quantity. Quantity is part of the Chachmas HaTorah. And that's what I'm saying. Chazal are using this gematria to direct us their attention to that. So the being off by two, I'm saying it's not an off by two. It's specifically the idea there's two and there's 611, and they're classifying the Torah as 2 plus 611. Torah's not 613. It's 2 plus 611. And the gematria is the 611.
Wow. And so essentially, as you're saying, is each kind of like fact intensive, each gematria to approach each specific topic is kind of what you're doing. So I want to talk about one other interesting one. Like you mentioned, the book goes through a bunch, like a patchwork gematria, there's halacha gematrias. The one I mentioned about the tzitzis were jumbled. Then you have reverse gematrias, which is what we already mentioned. Reverse gematrias we already mentioned before. We won't go through it, where the Torah gives us the number and there's, oh, that's Eliezer. Or you have the word jumbles, the famous one, the very famous Rashi, or it's not Rashi, it's a Talmud, but the Imlavan Garti, Tariag Mitzvah Shamar, it's a Garti, becomes Tariag. But anyway, you mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned, but there's another one that's interesting about strange connection. Maybe you want to discuss where sometimes you have. Especially this comes up in Megillah about Haman, and there's something you want to mention here.
Yeah, okay, for sure, definitely. Yeah, so this is again, it's called strange connections, because certain times gematrios connect up words which on the surface have absolutely nothing to do with one another. And this is one of these things which I think bothers people. Where these two words are related, what's the connection between the two? So I thought this is good to do anyways as we're approaching Purim. So not sure when we're going to go live here, but it's around Purim time. So it's in the Megillah. So there's we know that Haman offered to pay to, he didn't only make a plan to execute all the Jews, but Haman offered to pay Ahasuerus to execute all the Jews. And the king, Ahasuerus, said, no, 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 it's okay. And this is in Gimel Yud Aleph 3:11 in the Megillah. It says, Ahasuerus said, HaKesef Nosan Lach, the money is given to you, Ve'am Lasos Bo Katov Ve'nach. And you can do whatever you want with the nation. So the Megillah, it says, HaKesef, the money, HaKesef, is given to you. You could keep your money. And the Tosos in Megillah, it's based on the Medrash, Tosos in Megillah and Yud Gimel and Beis says, HaKesef is the gematria of HaKesef is 145 is the same gematria, no, 165 is the same gematria as HaEitz. Okay, HaEitz and HaKesef is the same. HaEitz is the tree and the money. And the Tosafot says it's a hint. Ahasuerus was hinting to Haman that he was going to be hanged on a tree. HaEitz. So the question is, what's the connection? Is it true? Ahasuerus was hinting, and this is at the beginning of the Megillah, was hinting to Haman that he's going to be hanged on a tree. He didn't know that he was going to be hanged on a tree. At this point, Ahasuerus and Haman were best buddies. And what does that mean that HaKesef means HaEitz? And they're two totally different words. They had the numbers add up. Well, what does it mean? And it's hard to interpret that that's pshat in the Megillah. What is the lesson? So, again, as I like to do, is forget the gematria and let's just look into the pasuk. Okay, let's just look into the. And as you said, it's a good point you mentioned, Achi, is that they're long-winded because, again, it's easy to find connections in gematria, or maybe it's easy. Some people like to, some people not. But the question is, what do we learn from gematria? And the way I see gematria is, it's a method of learning. Just like any other thing else in Talmud Torah, it takes analysis, it takes depth, and again, gematria is 200 pages, but it has 15 gematrias or something. Each one is another lesson. It's Talmud Torah. And that's what I'm trying to do, is to bring back gematria into the framework of Talmud Torah, of depth, of learning, of gaining insights. So what is this idea? If you ask a question, you might ask a question, why in the world did Haman, who seemed to be a smart guy, evil, but like an evil genius type of character, why is he offering to pay to kill the Jews? Doesn't that kind of give away the fact that he hates the Jews? Why is he paying for it? Right? Why did he offer the money? Right? And you might think it's not so important, but you see when Mordechai told Esther why he was sad, he told her about what happened, and he said specifically about the sum of money that not only was there a plan, but Haman offered to pay for it. So you see, the money was an important part of the whole story. He offered to pay for it. And that's what the gematria is drawing our attention to, the money. Why did Haman offer to pay for it? And I think the answer is straightforward, is that Haman had a plan. He had a plan to execute all the Jews. And he was going to convince the Ahasuerus of his plan. But at the same time, any plan, you could have a senator who could pass a bill. It's a nice bill, but how much does it cost? Ahasuerus loved money. He was really into his money. And you might have the greatest plan in the world, but who's going to pay for it? And is it worth it? And Haman knows that Ahasuerus may have resistance. He may like the plan in theory, but when he hears about the price tag, after all, it's expensive to kill all the Jews in the kingdom, right? So he may say, nah, I pass. It's too expensive. I'm not willing to spend that money. So what Haman did is he says, you know what? I'm so confident that this is a good idea, I'm willing to pay for it. I know that the Jews are so bad for the kingdom, I'm willing to pay for it. And what that does is it allows Ahasuerus to not have the monetary resistance. And then Ahasuerus says, really? Okay. And then he thought into it. He says, you know what? I hear you. You put your money where your mouth is. I accept it. Good plan. I'm going to do it. Keep your money. So it was like part of the way Haman was able to push through his plan was by offering the money. And that's why I think when Mordechai told Esther about what happened, why it's so tragic, why you got to do something today, go in there today, why is it so important? Because don't think this plan is going to fall through. You might think, I know what you're thinking, the plan is going to fall through. No, it's not going to fall through. Haman offered to pay for the plan. There's the money behind this plan. This plan is going to go through. And if you don't do something about it quick, this thing's going to happen. So it was very important, the money. The money was a big part of the story. Now the question is what happened? How did it? Why did the plan fail? So I think we have to gain some insight. And this is I want to like kind of this is the way I understand Esther's plan, and it's based upon Chazals and Gemaras and Merabeim and sort of ideas I've had over the years. But let me tell you a little bit about what was Esther's plan. That's sort of a funny plan, the whole thing with the party and then the second party. And what was she doing? What was her whole plan? How did she ultimately lead to Ahasuerus, to Haman's downfall? And I think the key is that she realized that the only way to undermine this plan was to break the strong connection between Haman and Ahasuerus. She knew that as long as there's a bond between Haman and Ahasuerus, Haman hates the Jews. You're never going to get Haman off of that. He hates Mordechai, hates the Jews. You got to break so division between Haman and Ahasuerus. And her plan was like this, is that she made a party. She risked her life. This was Mordechai told her. She risked her life. She put her life on the line. And obviously something major is up. If you're putting your life on the line, if the queen is risking her life, obviously something big, big news going on. And she made a party, and she invites to the party, special private party between the king and the queen and Haman. And Ahasuerus is wondering, what in the world is there's a private party between me and my wife? Why is Haman doing here? And sure enough, she had the party, and she created mystery. At the first party, she would not reveal what in the world it was about. And as you know, that's getting Ahasuerus to think something major is up. Something's going on. Maybe something that's life and death is going on. I have no idea. And what's Haman doing here? And through that night, plan of Esther caused Ahasuerus to not be able to sleep. And all night long, he was wondering, tossing and turning, what's going on? I have no idea. And he's starting to think, what's Haman involved in it? Is there some plot? Maybe Haman's involved. I have no idea. And sure enough, he couldn't sleep. And he asked to get the Sefer HaZichronos. The reason why he wanted that book, he says, maybe there's somebody, if there's a plot underway, I have to reward somebody. I have to make, maybe there's someone who hates me because they didn't reward him. And sure enough, as the Hashgacha saw to it, that the book ended up opening up to Mordechai. And he read the book. And sure enough, he says, Mordechai rewarded me and I saved my life and I didn't reward him. So sure enough, at that very moment, Haman was coming into the palace. And why was Haman coming to the palace? Because someone felt that as the party, this is another part of Esther's plan, is that the party played into Haman's ego. He felt like a million bucks. But the second he left that party, he saw Mordechai and he felt like nothing. He says, it's Chosein and Ashavli, it's worth nothing to me. But when you build up his ego, you cause him to get full of himself. And then he so hated Mordechai when he saw him not move that he decided that he had to come in the middle of the night. At that very night, he had to come in to tell Ahasuerus about his great plan to execute Mordechai. But again, Ahasuerus already, due to Esther's plan, was already questioning the loyalty of Haman. It started getting him jealous, a private party, me and my wife and Haman. And sure enough, when Haman came in at that very moment in the middle of the night, as we all know, Ahasuerus set him up and says, what should I do to the person who the king wants a reward? And he was Mordechai, who he knows is the one who Haman is against the Jews. And sure enough, Haman goes on and says, put the crown on his head. And that's when then Ahasuerus says, okay, so do all this stuff for Mordechai Yehudi. And this was the beginning of Esther's plan succeeding. It was creating a division between Ahasuerus and Haman. It was causing Ahasuerus to suspect, maybe Haman's not really my great friend. And this was all part of Esther's plan. Now, what happened was that the next day, finally, now she knew that she could make a move on Haman. Now that she saw that Ahasuerus humiliated Haman, she saw the next day. So the next day, what did she say? She said, amongst the rest of our plea, she said, because my nation, karnu ami v'ami l'hashmid, right? My nation has been sold. And if only they would have sold me to be servants, I would have been happy because I don't want the destruction of the king. And Rashi explains that she's saying that if Haman is really your friend, right? If Haman is really your friend, Ahasuerus, and he's really looking out for the best interests of the kingdom, then why kill good servants? The Jews are good servants. At least enslave them. And Esther's saying, look, I would not say a thing. If you wanted to enslave us for the monetary interests of the kingdom, I don't want to harm the king. I'm happy to work for the king, serve for the king, all that. But Haman's killing us. It doesn't make any sense. Is that a rational thing to do? Why destroy good servants and kill them all? I'll tell you why. Because Haman is an evil person and he has a personal agenda and he's trying to take us down. And then, sure enough, Harvona says, look, and he built a tree for Mordechai Yehudi, and that's it. Hatalu Alav. That was it. Now, Esther's plan ultimately, if you had to summarize it, was to show Ahasuerus that Haman was personally motivated. That was her pitch, that he was not looking out for the best interests of the kingdom, but he's looking out for himself. Now, well, did that resonate in Ahasuerus? Did Ahasuerus hear that point? And I think the answer is yes. There's a part of Ahasuerus which knew that. Why did he know it? It goes all the way back to the beginning, to the fact that Haman offered to pay for this proposal. Because after all, and I know we said the opposite a few minutes ago, but why is he paying? Why is the officer paying for the entire plan? Is that normal? Does a senator pay for an entire plan which he passes tries to pass in the government? It doesn't happen. I'll tell you why he's paying for the whole plan, because he has personal skin in the game. He's doing it for his own personal best interest. That's why he's doing it. So when she said that Haman has his own best interest in mind, in Ahasuerus' mind, he's thinking back to that thing. It's true. After all, it's a good point. He offered to pay for this plan. That does indicate that he's got personal interest, personal motivation. Now, you might ask a question, but one second. As we said earlier, the reason why she's offering to pay for the, that he's offering to pay the plan is to show that he's putting his money where his mouth is, to show that he really believes in it. So is it a good idea? Is it a good idea to offer to pay for the plan because it shows that you're committed? Or is it a bad idea because it shows that it reveals your personal best interests? And I think the answer is quantity. The answer boils down to quantity. The answer which the Gematria is directing to us is it's a good plan. It's worthwhile to pay for the plan, but only so much. What would have been so bad? Let's say a Haman offered to pay 10% or 20% of the plan. It would have showed Ahasuerus that he's serious, but it wouldn't have gone over the top. See, Haman made a good plan, but misjudged the quantities. He paid every last dollar. He offered to pay for the entire plan. It's just too much. He got excited by a good idea, and he misjudged the quantities. And plans, good plans. You may have a good investment strategy. You may have a good stock to invest in, but how much money should you put into it? The quantity is so important. You may want to spend time with your family, but you may want to spend time learning Torah. How much quantity? How do you balance the different quantities? And any good plan in our life is not enough just to have good qualitative plans, but we have to carefully judge the quantities. And I'm saying Chazal using Gematria to show Ha'etz, Ha'kesef to Ha'etz, is that because the quantity of the Kesef, because the Ha'kesef, because Haman offered too much money, because he got too carried away with this plan and he offered to pay for the entire plan, that was what the quantity indicated to Ahasuerus. And in a way that he didn't notice it at the moment. At the moment, he was excited also. But later when Esther made the accusation, it resonated and he thought back, it's true. He offered to pay for the entire plan. And that's why Chazal are specifically using the Gematria to show us that was Haman's mistake. To highlight, to target, to direct our attention towards the role of quantity in decision-making. We learn this is from Haman's mistake, but it's a lesson for all of us. When we make plans in our lives, we have to not only think out good plans in the qualitative dimensions of the plans, but we have to carefully assess the quantities. And if we don't, then we could suffer great consequences. So once again, I'm saying the Gematria is specifically directing our attention to the quantity. Yeah.
Okay, that's one of your main overarching themes here, and as well as, you know, like I said before, going is, you know, content-specific based inquiries that you're engaging in a lot of these examples. And there are more in the book, which people can read. So is that why did you decide to write a book? Is that you had all these ideas, you had all these gematrias, you wanted to give the wider public access to ideas about, another idea about Gematria, explanations about Gematria?
Yeah, good question. So let me quote for you, actually. So Rav Breidowitz, just like Breidowitz, wrote Haskama to the Sefer. And let me read you something which he wrote. And I think it encapsulates kind of the motivation of why I decided not just to give Shurim on this, but to try to disseminate these ideas to a wider audience. So he says as follows. He says, and yet over the years, Gematria has acquired a bad reputation, particularly and paradoxically among Talmidei Chachamim, who often roll their eyes when they hear yet another clever example. Gematrios often seem arbitrary. They bear no connection to the text from which they originate. They reveal no new insight or deeper understanding and seem geared more to entertainment than true spiritual edification. I speak, of course, of modern Gematrios, not those of Chazal and Mekubalim, but even for those, finding a meaning we can hold on to is often frustrating and elusive. And what Reidowitz is expressing is, again, this is what I feel, is that there are many people. I see Gematria is one of those topics which has mixed opinions, but many people who love it. But there are a lot of people, and as he's saying, oftentimes Talmidei Chachamim and people have a negative attitude towards gematrias. And when I kind of what I think is to discover the beauty of gematria, the depth, the ideas, how Chazal in their way, it's to teach us deep ideas through gematria. I thought it would be nice to share this with others, to be able to allow people who have a negative view of gematria to be able to, in a certain sense, to rescue it, if you will, in their eyes, to be able to refigure. That's what the book is called, Gematria Refigure, to refigure gematria, to be able to have a new perspective and to see gematria not as just one of these, you know, simplistic, superficial connections, but as a source of insight into Divrei Chazal, like anything in Chazal. So that's kind of why I thought it would be a good idea.
Okay, so the book, and now, obviously, if anyone is, those who are still listening at this point, or, you know, have heard from you, they can get kind of more of this in the book. But just what would you say? Why should someone read the book?
Okay, so I guess you could say, again, the way I see it is there's two types of people, again, about gematria. Most people split into two camps of gematria. There's those people who love it and those people who are more skeptical. And I really think the book could talk to both people. Is if you're a type of person who loves gematria and you're looking for something a little bit deeper, you're trying to see maybe there's something even more that I could get out of gematria. Besides for the connections, I could gain some more depth, some more insight, some more, you know, a deeper perspective. I just recommend that type of person would I think would appreciate the book. And also, if you're the type of person who's skeptical of gematria, again, I was skeptical of gematria. I now love gematrias, and I love the insights again from them. But again, you may not, from hearing me talk for an hour or so, you may not be convinced. I would suspect you're not. And if you're interested in seeing whether you are convinced, again, I only give you a few examples here, and it's a quick presentation. You know, if you're curious, and maybe you feel like me that, you know, I do have these doubts about gematria, but at the same time, I realize it's part of Torah, and I'd love to see if I could, there's something here, more here, deeper here, then I'd recommend you to take a look and see if you could, you know, see if you like it, see if you agree, disagree. I'd love to hear from you if you have any comments or thoughts or, you know, anything like that.
Okay, so I will link. Okay, first of all, I will link to the book for those interested in purchasing it. I'll put a link in the show's notes, the Mosaica's website, Feldheim's website. It's in local farm stores. And I don't know if there's anything else you want to mention about a website, a podcast that you have, and any other things that you want to just add here.
Yeah, I want to do that. But before that, I just want to do one thing I just want to mention beforehand, before we go here, is that there's a Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim where he talks about, he says there's a lot of people who have certain questions on the Torah. And he talks about, like, some people ask, you read Torah Shavuot, and you say, why does the Torah have to talk about all the genealogies? So many generations, and this person lived that many years and had kids, and this many years and that kids. And there are other parts of Torah, like all the travelings. They went to here, and they traveled here, and they traveled here, and all certain details of the Torah you might think are, what's the point? Why does the Torah have to do this? And the Rambam goes on to elaborate, gives reasons for those few examples. But he says the general klal. He says, anything which is hidden from you, and you might wonder, why does the Torah do this? He says, you should know that there's a good reason for it. And he says, he quotes a Chazal, which say, the Pasuk says, ki lo davar reik hu mikem. The Torah is not an empty matter from you. And Chazal say, ki lo davar reik hu mikem. That if the Torah seems empty, you should know, mikem, it's from you. And the idea is that, this is what I've learned from my study of Gematria, is that I used to think I had my doubts. I kind of was skeptical about gematria. But ultimately, gematria, as the rest of the Torah, there are often parts of the Torah which might seem to us, I don't know, does that really make sense? Is that certain mitzvahs perhaps we don't quite understand? And we have to realize the Torah is divine. It's passed down through Chazal. And it's not an option for us to just say, oh, I don't like that part of the Torah. That's not for me. That mitzvah doesn't quite talk to me. Gematria doesn't quite talk to me. Is we have to realize that even though we don't necessarily understand certain parts of the Torah, ki lo davar reik hu, Torah is not empty. And if it feels like it is, it's mikem, it's from you. And that's something which I learned, is that I had my doubts and my misgivings about gematria, but I discovered with patience and with years that it was because I had a failing and I had a lack of knowledge. And I think this is an attitude I've learned for sure going forward, that we don't necessarily have to force an understanding or an explanation of something in the Torah, but we do have to remember that it is from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And we don't understand everything in the universe. We understand everything in the, right? Sometimes we don't understand parts of the Torah, but that's okay. Sometimes we have to wait and learn and see what we can learn. Now, again, if anyone was interested in finding out some more, I would recommend you get the book. Or you could, I have a website, gematriarefigured.com. I also have a podcast called Gematria Refigured Plus, where I talk about these Gematria ideas and other related types of ideas and Chumash. So I'd recommend, I'd love anyone, again, on the website, you find a place to get in touch with me, or you could email me at gematriarefigured@gmail.com. And I'd love to hear from anybody. If anyone has any comments, anyone likes what I have to say, Gematria, dislikes it, has comments. I'm always looking to learn. I'm not fixed on this idea, this approach. I'd love to hear if anyone has any questions, thoughts, different perspectives, you know, anything like that. But again, I'd like to thank you, Nachi. It's been a pleasure to be here with you today. And I love listening to your podcast, and you know, love to continue learning.
Thank you for that. I'm glad that you're enjoying it. And yeah, I can add that email. I'll put that as well with the website and the podcast and the book link all in the show's notes. Okay. And people can reach out to you if they're interested in hearing more. And thank you for joining me. And hopefully it was, you know, interesting for the listeners as well to hear about Gematria more than, you know, what you might hear, like you said, Vayashav Brachis or Bar Mitzvah, someone saying a cute Gematria, and here you could understand Gematria a little bit more in depth. So thank you.
Sure, pleasure.